This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Hello. Hello. Okay, I heard some static here, but I am so happy. Well, you know, maybe it's a sign. I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper somebody today who, it's a big subject, and I'm so happy to welcome Norman Solomon to talk today about War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Hi, Norman.
I think we have a mistake. This is William Maz.
Oh, I'm sorry, William. Well, I'm happy that you're here. Okay, because, you know, I'm going to be talking, I guess, to Norman at the bottom, which is interesting because his book, now this is very funny. This doesn't happen very often. I have both of your books, the covers of both of your books, and they look so much alike because you are both talking about war. And his book talks about and it covers the wars that we're having now in the Ukraine that, you know, it's unbelievable. And your book is so good. You know, I was really thrilled to get it because, it's the second book. The first one, the Bucharest Dossier, was really great. But this new one, it's called The Bucharest Legacy, and it's The Rise of the Oligarchs. And, you know, the truth is most Americans don't have any idea what an oligarch is.
Yeah.
So
let me go into it.
Yeah. I you have to explain it because they hear that term, and I don't know if it's been deliberately just tossed around. I mean, anybody who's lived in Europe, we know what oligarchs are. But here in America, sort of maybe in some spy movies they mention it, but Americans don't understand what an oligarch is. And it's hard to understand how they have so much power.
Well, let me get into the definition. First of all, oligarch goes back all the way to Aristotle. And by definition, an oligarch is not just a wealthy person. You know, Bill Gates would not be considered an oligarch because he created his own company from nothing and so forth. Oligarchs are wealthy people whose wealth depends on the leader. Now, in the old days, was the king. And the king, like in England, they didn't call them oligarchs. They called them earls and dukes. What the king does is he gives part of his wealth, land with serfs on it, to loyal friends or soldiers, knights them, and makes them part of the oligarch system to control the country. And that is exactly what has happened in the former communist states. It didn't happen just in Russia. It happened in every single one, practically, with a few exceptions, of all the communist states that turned to capitalism. And so these oligarchs became wealthy when the transition to democracy happened and all of the companies owned by the communist government had to be privatized. And that was very much corrupted. And these companies ended up in the hands of a few. And they became immensely wealthy overnight. At the same time, they bought up media companies, which they used to prop up the new government that took power after communism, which was made up of the old communist people anyway, because those were the only politicians that were running, were old former communist men. So the oligarch, again, is an old system that the communists used during that transition process. And it survives to this day in all of them.
Well, you know, William Maz, you were born in Bucharest. So it's really perfect that you have this subject to write about, because it is fascinating. As I said in the first book, where we were talking about the Bucharest dossier, this was at the time of the revolution, right when it was happening. And the new book is, 4 years later? I think 4 years later. 3 years later. And now you're talking about what's happening. And in some ways, things are still, that are happening and are still bad. So most, again, we have this lovely thing here in America of completely ignoring things. When I was a kid, my favorite subject was geography in grade school. I loved geography. I thought it was so much fun. All those maps and the pretty colors, and you got to draw them, and then you learned about the countries, and in those days they actually talked about the countries. So, you know, we knew where they were, and we knew something about them. I don't think you could find very many Americans who could find Romania on the map.
Right. Well, I can tell you it is right next to Ukraine.
Which I know, so, and they don't know that.
Which is right next to Russia.
Which is, yeah, so it's all in there. And, of course, we tried, my husband and I were not allowed to get into Romania. He had an Israeli passport, so he couldn't get in. We managed to get a few steps into Yugoslavia, and as a matter of fact, let's just say my husband managed to go to the bathroom there, and that's as far as they'd let us into Yugoslavia. So we've been to that area. We know those countries. And how terrible. We did, of course, go into Poland, and people don't understand how really terrible things were in those countries. Yeah. The lines, the corruption, the needing to pay for any little thing you wanted. We found that when we were driving through Poland. I mean, every place we went, somebody wanted something.
Right. Of course. Now, let me just explain to you how corrupt the communist system was and how that helped the oligarchs. Because in the communist system, everything was based on the bakshish. That's a Turkish word that means the bribe. Everything from having the butcher save you a slab of beef to buying a car. Instead of waiting 5 years, you could put your name up higher on the list if you bribe the manager, to seeing a doctor. Without money, they won't see you. Without your grandmother's old jewelry, you're never going to have surgery. All the way up to the corrupt officials who always demanded bribes, and especially from any company that wanted to do any business in Romania. So they became wealthy even under communism, and they had offshore accounts, including Ceausescu, who was thought to have had over $1 billion, but they never found it. Now, because everybody was used to corruption, Ceausescu knew about this, but this is his oligarch system during the communist system. He knew everybody was stealing from the government coffers, but he let them do that because he wanted to keep them close. And all of this stuff was put into the security services dossiers, their files. When communism fell, the security service, the Securitate, had all of these dossiers at their fingertips with which they could blackmail all the government officials, parliamentarians, judges, and so forth, in order for them to allow the oligarchs to get all these companies. So that's with the bribe and with the blackmail is how these security officials became the new oligarchs. It's not an accident that the people in charge of the companies in Russia are all KGB, former KGB. It's the same thing happened in Romania. They're all former Securitate people or their sons and daughters now who own all of these major companies. And they did it by using these archives of dossiers to blackmail all the officials who had been corrupt during the communist system. And they had all been corrupt because that was the way the system worked.
Now, your main character, so you've written this really fascinating spy story about a CIA agent, Bill Heflin, who himself was born in Bucharest, but is an American. So tell us, you know, may, how much of it, how much of him is you, but I would say there are some parts of it that probably are. So
let me tell you. You know, when they asked Flaubert, who is Madame Bovary, he said, Madame Bovary is me.
Yes.
Now, Bill Heflin is not me, but I use parts of me. You know, I did have a girl in Romania that I left behind named Pusha, but that was in the first book, but I never went back to see her. So the rest is fiction. I did go to Harvard, but I was never recruited by the CIA. And so forth. I, you know, some of the things in Romania that I portray happened to me. Many of them happened to relatives or friends. And so I use what I can. You know, my loyalty is to the story, to a higher truth that the story hopefully can portray. And so that's all I can say about that.
Well, you've developed a great character, and one that is growing as you're progressing, and I'm sure there's going to be more books. It's going to be a lovely, nice, long series, because he is interesting, and the characters around him are interesting, and there's a lot of room for growth. So now that he finds himself going back to Bucharest on assignment, in this book, do you want to tell people about what his assignment is in this book?
Well, sure. So, first of all, at the end of the first book, there are several things left hanging, so I try to take care of those in the second book. But the second book begins with Heflin doing an exfiltration of a KGB agent who wants to defect from Bucharest. Finally, it goes wrong, but finally when he does get him to back to Langley, the agent tells, the defector tells him that there is a mole inside the CIA, and that the handler of the mole is a KGB agent known as Boris. Now, if anybody has read the first book, they will know that Boris was actually Heflin's asset inside the KGB. So now everybody suspects that Boris was actually a triple agent who was handling Heflin, and inside the CIA that Heflin is a traitor. And so he must now go back to Bucharest to find Boris and clear his name. And there is where he meets the oligarchs and the corrupt system that has risen out of the ashes of communism and that has stolen democracy from the people of Romania.
And it's an ongoing thing. It hasn't really changed. The problem is you have moles within moles. I mean, that everybody,
yes,
you don't know who to trust. And that, of course, has all been the case. It was the case in, I don't, you know, I remember when I went to Moscow that I never would go in a shower without a nightgown on because you knew they were watching you. And to live under that kind of life where you knew everybody was watching you and reporting on you, and your friends and family, you're not sure even about them.
Well, you knew in Romania that all of the telephones came from the factory with a microphone inside of them. And that microphone could not just listen to your phone conversation, but it could hear everything that went on in the room. And it was illegal to remove it. So whenever you went to somebody's home, you saw this cord going from the wall into a drawer or a closet because they wanted to muffle the sounds that the microphone could hear. So everything, you went to a hotel, the ashtray, the cups had microphones built in them. All the personnel, from the waiters to the bartenders to the cleaning ladies to the prostitutes that were everywhere, they were all working for the Secret Service. And they and their job, yeah, their job was to compromise you, you know?
The thing is, I mean, it makes for a fascinating story. That's why your books are so good. I mean, you've got it all. Of course, you've got beautiful women. For people who don't understand that this was a planned program to raise these girls, really from a young age, to act as spies. So it makes for your story. I mean, this gives you lots of possibilities.
Yes, it does. Now, well, you know, the first book started out as a love story. So that was a love story inside of a spy thriller, inside of a historical novel. I used the historical novel again 3 years later. The spy story is mostly resolved. The love story is mostly resolved. But the spy story continues because it has now become a cauldron of spies, of racketeering, of the underground, and of the government, all in one in Bucharest. And like I said, in practically every other former communist country. The only one that didn't was East Germany, because it immediately fused with West Germany, so they didn't have a chance to form oligarchs. But the oligarchs did not just control the new privatized companies. They managed arms dealing, illegal arms dealing to Yugoslavia. If you remember, during those days, Milosevic was butchering the Muslims there in Kosovo and Bosnia-Herzegovina. All of his arms came to Romania. And in fact, one of the arms dealers was a general, Stanculescu, who helped bring down Ceausescu, the leader, the communist leader, and became a hero. But then he quit government and became a wealthy oligarch by running guns. So that's the way things work there.
I don't know if people are going to Romania now, I think, as tourists and can see the country. My sister was married to a Romanian, so yes. I'm very familiar with Romanian food, which... I didn't like my sister's husband, but his mother was a cook. I mean, what she could make. Romanians make the best soup. Whatever you put in your soups, you have like a different ones, but there are different soups in Romania that are so good. And of course, the pastries and everything.
Let me tell you, Romania now is, you know, if you look at it, it is nothing like it was during the communist days. The standard of living has risen. Everybody's got iPhones, and it looks like a normal society, like any other European country. But underneath it, the people who run it are still the oligarchs, and it doesn't matter which party is in power. That's the problem.
That's a problem. Well, it makes for interesting reading in your book. And now, do you do Krav Maga yourself?
No,
you don't? Okay.
I do Mitite. You remember what they were?
Yeah.
They were these sausages, skinless sausages, and Mamaliga, which is this polenta.
Oh, yes. Well, I hope that people will get this book. It's just a good read. There's the romance, there's action, there's some good action in there, and a nice twisty plot, and you do not know exactly who is the bad guy. I can't say all the oligarchs are bad guys. I don't think there's a good oligarch. Is there a good oligarch?
Yes.
Are there good ones?
I mean, there's never a black and white. That's what I like. I'm towards the Jean Le Carré type of spy novel with less action, although I have plenty of action.
Yeah.
But I want it to be a thinking man's book.
Well,
a thinking woman's book.
Yeah, I think you're right. It is a thinking person's book because you do sort of sit back and you say, well, okay, this is interesting. I didn't know this, and lots of things to discover. And as I said, you do have, it always comes back with a book like this that you have to have a good character. And I think you've developed, you know, a nice character that people will care about, and that's important because you're going to keep writing about him.
Yes,
and
thank you.
And his background, and about, you know, I liked the when you wrote about Catherine, and about really a whole bunch of characters in there that I think Heflin is somebody who has a lot of stories in him.
Yes, I tried to make it more than just a spy novel.
Yes.
You know, I try to have the private stories of each one of my characters, and they all have something that they're looking for besides the spy plot.
Yes.
And so that I think makes it more interesting, and it tells you something about the country, like the Roma population, the gypsies that exist in Romania. They're the most downtrodden people there, and they have been used as an excuse for anything that goes wrong in Romania, and they're treated very badly. So I wanted to portray them and show what their situation is.
Okay, well, I think it's a fascinating book, and people definitely, when you finish this book, it's a standalone, but I'm sure you'll go back and read the first book because it is very good, and it's by William Maz, and this one is called The Bucharest Legacy, The Rise of the Oligarchs, or as I would say, the rise of the really, really bad guys. But it's a great book. And do you have a website you want people to visit?
Yeah, William Maz, one word, williammaz.com.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. Good luck with this book. You're working on the third one, I hope.
Of course.
Of course you are. I know it. Once you find that joy on paper, you can't stop writing.
That's right.
That's true. Okay, so I'll have you back here, sometime next year, right?
Hopefully, yes.
Okay,
hopefully.
Great. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, people, this is a good book, and it would be nice if more people would read books set in countries like Romania, and then you get to learn something about the places. And I love that. That's what I love to do, and that's why I love reading. Okay, we're going to have a Father's Day announcement and a few commercials, and then I will be back with Norman Solomon, and we are going to be talking today about war. Wow, big subject.
Hey, is a National Geographic Day here at Joy on Paper. Not a lot of dads wear ties anymore. A t-shirt that says, World's Greatest Dad is cool, but give your dad a gift that keeps on giving. A book from National Geographic is always perfect. There is a Nat Geo book for every subject under the sun. Wild animals? He'll love Carlton Ward's Path of the Panther that offers new hope for Florida's endangered panther. How about ancestors? Any Irish in your family? Then you must get Jack Kavanaugh's Always Ireland. It's heading into summer, the perfect time to go camping. Your dad will love 50 states, 5,000 ideas. Where to go? When to go? What to see? What to do is a book that showcases the best travel experiences in every state. From the obvious to the unexpected, it will keep dad turning the pages for hours. And then he'll want to grab that fishing pole and start traveling across America. National Geographic books are always treasured. Beautifully written and richly illustrated books from the world's greatest photographers. Give a gift of love. Give a gift that lasts. Go to National Geographic Books website and get inspired.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. And I am back with my next guest, Norman Solomon. The name of his book is War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. I'm so happy to welcome you to the program, Norman.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here, Patsy.
Well, I introduced it earlier. I said to people, this is a big subject. Now, I don't get a lot of really historians or people who really know a subject as in-depth as you do. But it is such an important subject, and I wanted to have you on because there is so much going on in this world, and today we just heard that they might be moving tactical nukes. Where are we? What is happening in this world? And I hope that perhaps you can help my listeners to realize that they have to pay attention because we don't know what's going on.
There is so much, as you say, happening, and very few of us have firsthand experience. So we're depending on, for good and ill, other sources, usually news media, to bring us up to speed. And quite often that messaging is filtered through agendas. And in a way, we could say everybody has their assumptions, and as the saying goes, sometimes the problem is not what we don't know, but what we know that just ain't so. And my purpose with the War Made Invisible book is really to try to cut through what's been called the fog of war and focus on what we can know, particularly if we are Americans, about our own government, what we've been doing in the last many decades for war or for peace.
Well, really, I'm going to put aside World War I and World War II, but we've been lied to since after World War II. We got into a mess in Korea because nobody reported and nobody told Americans what was going on there. Nobody knew in America that Stalin wanted a war in Korea. I mean, he wanted it to protect himself and to get things for himself. And nobody reported on it then. Then we headed off into Vietnam, again, where nobody's reporting the truth about what was going on there. And it's just been an ongoing thing to the point where we get to Afghanistan, which I could have told all of them right from day one that we would lose that war, because all you had to do is go back and read in history about the Punjab Wars with the British, and you knew you were in trouble. But nobody reports it.
Well, I think you've made a really good overview of, unfortunately, a lot of history of the last many decades in terms of U.S. military intervention. One way I put it sometimes is that, unfortunately, the major U.S. media outlets, when it comes to foreign policy and wars, tint our window on the world red, white, and blue. And that might make us feel good, but it doesn't mean it has very much clarity to offer about what the heck's going on. And in the cases you cited, well, let's talk about Afghanistan. This is a very effective media system on the whole when it comes to U.S. military interventions overseas. And in my book, War Made Invisible, one of the reasons I use that title is that it's almost impossible at times for us to even see through this fog of media war what the underlying agendas and, so to speak, what the underlying truths really are. And so we're so dependent on the TV, the radio, the big media outlet networks, the ones that have behind them really billions of dollars in assets of a particular firm. When I looked at what happened, a pivotal moment, of course, 9/11 was a horrible tragedy. It was a crime of huge proportions. At the same time, a few weeks later, in October of 2001, the United States government compounded the tragedy by sending the bombers and the missiles and the U.S. troops into Afghanistan. And after 3,000 Americans had died in the Twin Towers and at the Pentagon and in the field in Pennsylvania, then many more were to die, Americans and most, in terms of quantity, most of all, Afghans were to die. And I looked at a poll, Patsy, that really sort of blew my mind. In October of 2001, Gallup did a scientific survey of Americans, and the survey found that 90% of Americans wanted the U.S. military to attack Afghanistan, and 5% said they weren't sure. So what kind of a media system, and some would say propaganda system, functions when only 1 out of 20 people are opposed to the United States violating international law and attacking another country that really had zero of their citizens involved in 9/11. And I'll sort of sum up this way, not one of the 19 9/11 hijackers were Afghans.
So on whose shoulder does this land? Because we have media who, as you said, they're all powerful, and yet nobody has educated the Americans of where even these countries are, let alone the history of these countries. And now we're faced with the Ukraine, which is an absolutely ridiculous war. And, you know, you hear about art historians when they have to date a possible masterpiece, and they analyze the paint and they say, oh, well, we know this isn't a masterpiece because, boy, oh, boy, we can see radiation that happened in 1945. Well, at the rate we're going, we're going to have radiation in 2023. And, boy, people are really going to be able to carbon date. And nobody seems to take this seriously.
Well, this is an issue that I did get into in War Made Invisible, because the ultimate invisible war would be a nuclear war. And yet, after the Russians did their terrible, horrible invasion of Ukraine, President Biden, and this is not a partisan issue, President Biden gave his first State of the Union address. And it was a very long one, and I read every word. Not one of those words referred to nuclear weapons, nuclear war, or the dangers of nuclear annihilation that were being brought closer to us because of the standoff and the confrontation, really, between the two nuclear superpowers, the United States and Russia. And that pretty much, with some rare exceptions, has been the reality from that day to this. We just don't hear about it. We don't hear about it from Democrats or Republicans in Congress, with rare exceptions. We don't hear it from the big TV networks. We're not hearing it from the prestigious newspapers and magazines. This is really another way to make not only current war, but the dangers of an ultimate war invisible to us.
Well, if you look at it, as I went back to the Korean War, because really that war, everybody likes to think it was a China, you know, war. But it was actually right there. Stalin wanted that war. Stalin wanted the Vietnamese war. So Stalin wanted all the Russians. You know, they've got a long reach. And we're still going on with this nonsense because nobody reports it. And the American people are, by and large, ignorant, completely ignorant. When I was a kid, I was telling my earlier listener today, he wrote a book about Bucharest, and he's from Bucharest, so he can write a spy book set in Bucharest. He knows Bucharest. But that's William Maz, and he wrote a very fine book about, you know, the situation there.
Yeah.
But if Americans don't know where any of these countries are, I mean, this... We had geography class when I was in third grade, and we knew where all of these countries were. I don't know what. Where are you going to start informing people about the countries and the history of these countries?
Well, I think there is an assumption, often just tacit and sometimes explicit, whether Democrats or Republicans, we hear from presidents that the United States is the indispensable nation, that the United States is the exceptional country, and that conveys the idea that the United States is the center of the world and of the universe, and again, that might make us feel good, but the reality is, like it or not, we are 5% of the world's population, and there are a lot of other people in the world. And they have their own vantage points. And generally, those vantage points are neither more nor less valid than Americans are apt to have. And so in terms of history, yes, you know, Stalin was a tyrant, and the Korean War happened. He had passed away by the time of the U.S. direct intervention in Vietnam in the 1960s. But Vietnamese people generally didn't give a hoot about the Kremlin or the White House or anything else. They had their own lives, and they had their own suffering brought on them by the United States in huge quantities. And as has been the case after that, when people dissent in the United States and say, why are we attacking Vietnam? Why are we attacking Afghanistan? Why are we bombing and strafing and invading Iraq? We get called unpatriotic. And that's another way that there is huge messaging to tell us that these wars are good and that the suffering from those wars, especially the suffering from those at the other end of U.S. military firepower, that suffering is rendered virtually invisible.
Well, now, the subtitle of your book is How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. But the same could be said for Russia and definitely for China. What they did has not been reported. So
this is the nature, really, of governments, especially when they feel they have a stake in war or are involved. There's a great journalist who I mention and describe in this book, War Made Invisible. His name was I.F. Stone, and he said, all governments lie, and nothing they say should be believed. That's especially true in the case of war. As the saying goes, truth is the first casualty of war. And I.F. Stone was not saying that governments lie all the time. What he was saying is that governments often lie, and we should never take them on faith. We need facts, and we need true information. And that really was a motivation for me to spend years and years at the computer and reading and so forth, interviewing people for War Made Invisible.
Well, you know, when you look at it, I don't know who is going to do any reporting, because they are just, they just give us this fluff, they give us this fluff. For example, nobody knows, I'm sure no, very few people realize that a long time ago, as far back as John Kennedy, had seriously considered bombing the Chinese nuclear facilities, because he knew that someday they would be our biggest threat. And so we're not told anything about this. And I'm wondering, at which point, I mean, is it going to take somebody using, what's this idea that we can even report just sort of casually, oh, they're moving tactical nuclear weapons, but they're battlefield weapons, you know, they're just like right there. So like the nuclear carnage will be right there on, you know, pinpointed to some battlefield, and not understand it's going to be all over the place. It's going to be for the rest of the time that people exist. It's going to be in. I don't know how they can just report it without somebody stopping. Which reporter, which station, which person is going to get out there? Because obviously, it's not coming from anybody. Our leadership in Washington. Are they reading your book? I hope they're reading your book in Congress.
Well, I certainly hope so. We're offering, and I am talking, I have an appointment with one congressperson. I will hand the War Made Invisible to him. I think you're alluding to, you know, just such a crucial point that the casual discussion, if it's discussed at all, about so-called tactical nuclear weapons, let me be blunt here, that's insane. Because once you start to launch a nuclear war, when you have the United States and Russia armed to the teeth with thousands of nuclear weapons each, this is an invitation, a opening, and if the opening has gone through, a reality of what's been called omnicide. And I was very fortunate to interview for this book the great Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. And he pointed out that the best scientific studies are that with a full-blown nuclear war, which is predictably what would happen if a war with nuclear weapons started involving the United States and Russia, about 99% of the people on this planet would expire, largely because of what scientists have identified as nuclear winter, where the soot and the debris rising into the sky would not blow away, essentially. It would blot out the sun. And agriculture, within a few months, would be curtained. And the scientific evidence now is about 99% of people on the planet would expire within a matter of months. So why are politicians and news media using diplomacy as a dirty word, when there are suggestions that we need to have the U.S. government push for diplomacy with the Ukraine war? We're told that that's betrayal, that that's sellout, that we're siding with Vladimir Putin. No, and this is part of the theme of the book, that people who are stigmatized and trashed because they say they're alternatives to war, they are trying to, you know, like Cassandra, we are trying to say we must not head towards more and more destruction. There's such a thing as diplomacy. There are much better options.
And they better get this through their heads really fast. So if you're meeting people in Congress, tell them, you know, look back a little bit, read some history, and really learn what happened and where we hear this word disinformation, but there are people who are plotting bad things, and if you don't recognize it and then say, okay, you're right, you know, we have to solve this diplomatically. We have to just say, that's it. At some point, we have to say, that's it, because The more you arm, we give this, we give that, they give that, and it is going to result in the stupidity of a tactical weapon right on the battlefield. And a reporter was talking about it yesterday. Yeah, it's a battlefield. It's a battlefield weapon. Gee, you know, wherever you shoot off a nuclear weapon, that's a battlefield, all right.
Yeah, and the way that so many of the Pentagon-driven and White House and congressional-driven journalists are willing to be so flippant about it is really unhinged. You used a very important word, disinformation, and I would add to it another. There's one that has been cooked up called infotainment, where we're told it's information. It's really an effort to just entertain, bread and circuses, infotainment. And I have another word to add on to that, disinfotainment. We're being disinformed with disinfotainment. And we're supposed to have, in the United States, the informed consent of the governed. If we have the uninformed so-called consent, that's not democracy at all. And you used a very appropriate word for what we get so often in purportedly quality news media, and that is fluff. We don't get past history or current history, real-time history. We get fluff.
I bet I could take the whole bunch of White House and congressional reporters over there, and I could take them, and half of them wouldn't be able to find these countries that I could find when I was in third grade and I was drawing little maps of Europe, and I knew where the Ukraine was, for goodness sakes. I knew where Romania was. I knew where Poland was. Nowadays, these people don't read history. They don't understand about what happened all the way back to the Korean War. You tell them Stalin wanted the war, they say, why would Stalin want the war? Yeah, they are not informed. And then the American people have such horrendously bad education nowadays. I don't know where we're going to have informed people to make decisions.
Well, you mentioned the lack of knowledge in history, and a lot of what is emphasized is how great America is and how bad our designated enemies are. Now, there are great and wonderful, admirable things about U.S. history, and there also are opposite realities of what the United States has done to people. The Vietnam War is a terrible example, but a very real one. And you're reminding me that just a few years ago, somebody who was more adept at presenting like some kind of Hollywood starlet, but was the White House press secretary. And she said, when she was asked a question by a reporter, well, what are the implications for the present day of the Cuban Missile Crisis? Her reply was, oh, I'm not familiar with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'll have to look that up.
Well, the whole bunch of them. I'm telling you, they all need I don't know what will jolt them. Maybe if we have this tactical battlefield weapon, they might actually wake up and realize that we're in big trouble here, because maybe they'll read your book, I hope, which is called War Made Invisible. Now, as you said, the subtitle is How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. As somebody who has lived overseas in a lot of these countries that we're talking about, I have been in the middle of revolutions, I have been in the middle of riots, I have been in the middle of terrorist actions, more than I can tell you. And two times, it was a U.S. Marine who saved my life. So, you know, yesterday was Flag Day, and I know, you know, there are other countries in this world, but in the end, I don't find any people who want to run off and move to Cambodia or run off and move to any of these other countries. Everybody wants to come here. So I hope that when you talk to the leaders that you're going to be talking to because of this book, that that is also taken into consideration.
Absolutely, that we have, like so many countries, we have a mixed history, and we ought to be proud of what we should be proud of, and also be honest about what has been wrong with our U.S. foreign policy and how we've got to make it much better.
Oh, and wrong with our military intelligence, because somehow military intelligence is like lacking. There is no intelligence. They don't understand these people. They don't understand where they're going. They don't understand the minds of the people in these countries they go to. And that's part of the big problem. As I said, if they had understood the Afghanis, and if they would have read history, just the British history from the 1850s, they would have known what to expect.
Well, that would have been a much better outcome, to know what to expect by understanding history and the U.S. is not the center of the world, rather than the disaster that unfolded from arrogance and ignorance. You remind me, it's been said that the phrase military intelligence is so often an oxymoron. The joke is it's like jumbo shrimp, and we need to improve that too.
Yeah, well, you know, I've been a bit of a student of history since I started Latin, and I first translated Caesar's Gallic Wars. So I've put a lot of thought into it, and the biggest thing is that people have to know something about the world, and then perhaps they can make good decisions.
Absolutely, and the challenge is that I think authors have a role to play here. If we can learn more and dig deeper, we can create a better future for ourselves and the next generation.
And if we can somehow convince schools to teach phonics so that kids can actually read books, that would really be a big help, too.
Well, as an author and a reader, I say let's encourage the reading of books so that we can not just have this attention span of about 3 minutes that is encouraged by the corporate media.
You're right. Exactly. That's what they do. Feed you little drop by drop until your mind is so convoluted you don't know what you're thinking anymore. Anyway, it was a pleasure to talk to you today. And it's Norman Solomon, War Made Invisible. Do you have a website you want people to go to?
Yes. You can go visit thenewpress.com. That's thenewpress.com. And that's our publisher. And they give you more details if you click on books about War Made Invisible.
And I hope that you're going to be getting on some of those talk shows and with those talking heads, and perhaps you can talk some sense into them. How about
that? I'll try. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much, Norman. Nice talking to you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. The time has just run out. Anyway, everybody have a lovely weekend. It's hot here in Florida. My goodness, it's hot. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. Everybody have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And stay cool. And read a good book. Bye-bye.